Welcome to Between Two Clinicians, the podcast that gives you a backstage pass to the mind of two therapists. I'm Talia.
And I'm Adam.
Let's get into it. Fine.
That's
kind of,
how would you drive so far? I love it.
I was just like, wow, like it must be a fancy studio. Like I was like, well, this would be kind of cool to see what the background looks like and whatnot. And it's like, this studio looks a lot like your bedroom. Like, I don't know, like
this is the same room you've been. Yeah, no, it wasn't the city. That was my bad. We're in Riverside, the recording studio instead of Zoom. So that is what I should have said. But lesson learned. Here we are. And what is our topic for today?
I think the topic for today, I mean, as I didn't want it to be cliche, but it is. It's failure to launch, man.
Such a good movie, by the way. I just rewatched it the other day. So good.
I love that movie. Like, mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the better ones. Like, I'm sorry, yeah. I'll say How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days is a terrible movie, but Failure to Launch was the better version of that is how I really felt.
It really was. The meet cute part at the end where, and this actually, I think so many people saw this and used that as a blueprint of like, great, so all I have to do is find the guy who has it launched and make him fall in love with me and then eventually move him out. And then he'll fall in love and I'll be the one that he changes for. Like it hits on so many tropes. And I love that we get to dive into it today because you said you've been getting some inquiries of
the movie
almost.
It is. I feel like I have been getting more and more phone calls from parents that are trying to launch their child that has just like not ever moved into the, I'm going to really take ownership of my life and have true autonomy. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's shocking and it's not shocking at the same time. Cause like the three examples I have in my mind, their ages were 24, 26 and 28. And you're like, oh wow. Like, okay. And some were, you know, some had completed college, some had dropped out of college. Other ones were in trade schools. But I mean, there is this common theme of like, why is it that we have men in their 20s that just completely lack action in their life?
That is the question. Inquiring minds want to know. I have some thoughts on it that I think we can explore. I don't have raw data or research pulled up for this.
True.
So I'd say this is more a lived experience for sure, feedback based, and the way that I see societal shifts is definitely into this, that many decades ago this wasn't an option. Like this is true. That's a general statement, but that's true for many things now. There were different parameters that a lot of people were able to do now were not an option for better or worse. So when I say that generally to narrow it in on the failure to launch and the men that you're describing, the shame, I believe, of living at home, moving back home, anything to do with relating to like my dwelling is in my childhood home or with my parents is my home. The shame and stigma of that still there to some degree has largely lifted post COVID. Yeah. I think that is a grand scale because that is a completely understandable reason. I don't have a job anymore to pay the income that was paying for my house or I moved home to care for parents. And or I didn't want to live at home. I was just about to make this transition or this move for a career. And then it hit even before COVID. I just think that's one factor that now it's more normalized to talk about it. And there is less shame in sharing that to some degree. There's also a huge societal shift where there's not a need anymore for classic traditional man provider, woman receiver, two parent or two income or two person household systems look different now. You might not have kids. There's not a need for it. You might not want to be the worker anymore. And you might want to have your partner the partner wants to be the one who brings home the income, et cetera. And we talk about all the power dynamics and the polarity dynamics that go with that. Yeah. There are so many subtle nuances of why it's so much more normal now. There's almost this uprising of it's okay to be Peter Pan and different if the person wants to change it and the person is okay with it. If they're living at home happy as a clam and see no issue with it and have no intention of changing, I would say that is a red flag for both the individual and the potential partner. And if they're staying at home and they're like, look, this has got to change, I guarantee you those are not the ones whose moms are calling them, almost coddling. And like we talked about off air, there's a fine line between helping and enabling.
Oh, yes. And I mean, this is a Southern term, but it's called frog hair thin. And it's because they're so fine, right? Yeah. It's such a fine line.
Yes.
But I mean, I think you did a great job outlining a lot of things. And I was sitting here because I was just like, okay, listen to what Talia is bringing up, because you actually took it a different direction than I was going to take it. I think that this is like where I appreciate it, because I think like maybe as being opposite sexes, we have completely different perspectives on this.
Yes.
Because this is my thought process. I think there's twofold. I'm going to go into one, and I know that people are going to get fired up on it, but I want you to listen to me.
Take a sip of this and let's get going. Okay. It's also coffee, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. So.
So I believe what you're seeing when you see 20-year-olds who are failing to launch, 20-year-old males failing to launch, they're taking no action in their lives. I want you to just sit with this real quick, okay? I think toxic feminism has created fuckboys. Okay.
Ooh.
And I know that like a lot of people are like, wait a second. No.
Hang on.
Like, I'm on this planet because of a woman. I have a wife who's like bearing my first child. I am like, I am peak feminism supporter. Okay. But I have to admit that there's this other side of it that has taken a role where I think that there is suppression to what is masculinity. And masculinity is different. If we go to the 50s or the 60s and we talk about like grandpa and grandma and how they met, masculinity was a man who was able to protect, was able to provide, whose real foundation and core was rooted in making sure that my family had what they needed to have success in a safe place, and my children wanted to strive for their own dreams and all this. What ended up happening, though, is like we go through the decade of sexualization. It's all good, but there were bad things came of it, right? And what we did is we looked at the men who were the safe bets, the ones that were actually like, oh no, I want to be able to provide for a wife and have her at home. And we said, you're boring. You aren't thrilling. You don't have chemistry. And so what we did is toxic feminism came in, because again, we can always overdo something. We essentially overdid it to the line of all of a sudden we prioritized the men that had toxic relational traits. Mm. Like, oh, they're very charismatic, they're in great shape, the sex is wonderful, but I actually don't have a relationship with this person. And this person also has toxic charisma, so they're not just doing this with me, they're doing it with everyone. And what we're actually breaking relationships down is to this whole stigma of it's really like, it's funny to hear people slow down now on body counts when body counts used to be something you would brag about.
Yeah, like, it was a sign of who would be lauded.
And who was the most sexually liberated, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, that's actually very true. Who was the most sexually liberated and who was also the most sexually desirable?
Oh, yeah. And supposedly the higher the body count, the happier you were. Now, what we're getting into is, I mean, I love the Gottmans, right? The Gottmans have done the research on it. And even the Gottmans in the last 20 years have come back on a lot of things and said, like, you know, we're not seeing that higher body counts are then turning around to having people who are showing greater levels of happiness in relationships, or feeling more secure attachment in their relationships. We're seeing more of that anxious attachment. We're seeing more of individuals who are actually unhappy with their sexual lifestyles of the past. So I know you're going, well, Adam, how do you get to 20-year-old boys? So here's why I did this. As we end up moving into my second point, which I believe that a lot of marriages start out of like hot and heavy passion, right? And then life happens. And life happens, you have a child. It's no longer, you can no longer have sex in the kitchen all the time. You're not going away on these vacations. And so what ends up happening is I believe that there's triangulation that happens within that relationship.
Yep.
And it tends to be that some mothers will over prioritize that male child's relationship. And so now we have a mother who is in a position of enabling, largely because I think mom, and rightfully so, could be frustrated on, like, I'm scared about what an empty house looks like.
Yeah.
Like, we're always moving with secondary gains. I do believe at some point in time, mom comes to the epiphany of, like, no, I want to have my own life. I don't want to be caretaking for a man child. True. But then you have 20 years of this reinforcement of, you don't need to do your laundry, you don't need to be really responsible for anything. We'll let you know what's for dinner, we'll get you your favorite snacks and put it in the fridge. And you essentially have this man child who has never been able to actually feel the consequences of his own actions, because that fine line of, are you helping or are you enabling?
Would you say part of it, we're going to talk about this for a long time, so I'm excited. Would you say part of it could potentially be a utilization of a child to fulfill an unmet parental need?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what you end up happening is you have, you have maybe in that case that mother trying to utilize that male child for appreciation, for acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. And your life work is then just trying to keep this person happy. The problem is you get locked in this battle of, you're essentially raising a miserable person.
Yeah.
Because they aren't overly happy with what is happening, but they're also complacent enough to let it continue to go. Now, yeah. I want to just preference it because I don't want people out there saying, oh, you're just bashing on moms. Bashing on moms at all. I feel like, again, what I've been talking about is not all moms. I believe that this could be toxic maternal relational dynamics where, I wonder what would happen if mom processed some things for her own self and maybe ended up finding an identity that was outside of motherhood, because there's a transition there. And I'm seeing it in my own wife. I can't wait for our first child to get here. Motherhood is a huge thing, and I'm watching her sort of embody this identity and, like, grow with this identity. But then we've also been very, like, cognizant of, like, I guess it's just our age as well, of, like, we have some friends that are launching their last child, right? So we're watching then as they're going from primary parents to now being secondary voices in their children's lives. Right. But now they're moving back to being primarily husband and wife, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that that's another failure, is when you don't make that movement in identity. Absolutely. For 20, 30 years, primarily your identity was wrapped up in being a mother. But now it's actually time to get back to, like, who you are.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that for yourself, then what happens is you'll end up triangulating and slowing down that next developmental step for your 20-something-year-old son.
Yeah, we talk about this a lot in my analytic training, the emotional incest. I have it at my office. I don't have it at my home office library, but the books describing and detailing, and I will pull this up so I don't misquote it, but sometimes it's called the chosen child syndrome too. Mm-hmm. It's an unhealthy family dynamic where a parent relies on their child for emotional and practical advice and support. So this, I think, harkens back to what we either actually are or perceive we are lacking in our adult primary romantic relationship, if we're married and parenting with the person. I'll use the terms interchangeably just for the sake of this episode. The person we are parenting with, who we're also married to. So when one becomes two, we choose a relationship. And then our two-ness in analysis or analytic language becomes three-ness and four. Like, we bifurcate continually when we're not just that dyad anymore.
And
can the couple parent creatively? Can they leave space for this entity and being as separate from us? It came from, ideally, care and love for the two-ness, so much so that we want to create more and share in this, knowing full well as much as you're able to. Obviously, I always joke, imaginary kids are the easiest to raise.
Yeah.
Some of those changes, and what are some of those needs? So that's as a foundation. What are some of those needs for the mother, in this case, that might, to use what you've shared about with people calling in, that may not have gone met in the primary, you know, marital relationship, mm-hmm. that then are projected or introjected or, you yep. know, engaged with the son, because at a base level, and I've talked to parents who have mm-hmm. thought about it this way, years and years ago, well, why did you want to have kids? Well, I just wanted somebody to love me unconditionally is what I've heard. I wanted a chance to do it right. Like I never had, like there's a myriad of reasons why people subconsciously,
and I wanted a little buddy.
I wanted a best friend. I wanted this. I wanted somebody to dress up, and mm-hmm. don't realize sometimes how much these sentiments do at the surface. You're like, oh, that's kind of creepy or weird. But deep down, there's a severe need that is often going unmet mm-hmm. and an unrealistic expectation. And this is where the emotional incest comes in, is if I can't get that need met from my adult partner, he's so incompetent. He's so this. Mommy's yeah. special angel. You're mommy's special boy. You know mommy so well, it creates almost this, it's almost like a heartburn feeling that I get when I talk about it, because I'm not saying disgusting, like I'm shaming it. There's a level of disgust as an emotion that gets evoked in me, because I've seen this happen in families. I've seen what the long-term 10, 20, 30 year outcome of this is in my own personal life and family systems I'm familiar with. Where that is so inappropriate, and it sets a very inappropriate tone for marital and romantic expectations of the son. Mm-hmm. A Mother Enmeshed Men is one of my favorite books in the whole world. And I will use a bit of self-disclosure because I think it's funny and I do it as a comedy bit. I dated a guy once, very well to do, super hot, great catch. Like all the check boxes were marked, minus the relationship with mother. And yeah. I stumbled upon this book in classic therapist, dating your case studies, et cetera, not dating a client, but like you read the books and you're like, why am I doing that? This is weird. It's years ago. And I remember bringing this up to the person and I'm like, this is going to be a concern. I'd really like you to read this so we can address it, because mm-hmm. this is the only red flag that I'm really seeing. And in true form, he goes home.
Gave it to his mom.
I was yep. like, so my work here is done. Also, this yeah. answer. Question I could have had, well, this is no longer like that. That to me was all I need. I didn't even need to say anything. The action, the behavior alone proved, like, it was just, I loved it.
Yeah,
so
we're done, unfortunately.
I was like, yeah. So understanding that mother enmeshment, because of the primary maternal preoccupation as well, our bodies are, if we're able to breastfeed, obviously, our bodies are what provide sustenance, but regardless of the ability to breastfeed, the parental set or whoever the primary caregiver is, or hopefully two caregivers mm-hmm. are, there's still the balance of, do I trust my spouse enough on mm-hmm. a spousal level that when the spouse becomes a father, I trust him? And this gets into all of what mm-hmm. Eve Ross talks about in Fair Play, etc. Do I trust you enough, or do I view you as competent enough to do this with me? Or do I usurp the power of the husband, in this case, in the heteronormative dynamic? Yeah. Or, and this actually, when we've done the research on it, even analysis, is true for couples of the same sex or couples who mm-hmm. are gay, LGBTQ, that there's still that two-parent dynamic where there's mm-hmm. power and control. Does the primary parent trust the auxiliary parent, if you will, whether that's by choice or by force? Yeah. And can we view it equally, or is there this emotional incest where you know me in a way nobody else does? You literally grew inside of me and came out of me. And it is sometimes overwhelming to the nervous system to talk about it, because that's the yuckier part of describing that. Mm-hmm. Of course they know you in a way that your husband never will. He's been inside of you. I'm not meaning to be crass here, but he's been inside in a way, in a much
different way. But he didn't gestate in you, right? Like, right?
Like that's where that needs to be addressed. And this is, again, classic depth here of going to that level. But I think that sometimes sets the foundation for it. And every parent, for the most part, I would say, the curse of the good enough parent, mm-hmm. most parents who are caring enough to do this, it just goes on overdrive. Like, we need to rein it back in, because as an adult, you need to let them fail. You need to let them suffer, not needlessly, but you can't go in and rescue mm-hmm. mommy's special angel from anything. Cause then what's going to happen if they meet a girl? You betray, you sabotage, you cut her out because you don't want to.
You undermine. I mean, and it's funny because it's the same, you'll see the same relational dynamic. So normally what happens in this mix is like, so if primary parent doesn't feel like auxiliary parent shows up, yeah. or I always say secondary parent, yeah. Normally the primary parent will work to constantly undermine the image of the secondary parent. So like, yeah. it's like your dad's not here. Yeah. And I see this a lot. It's interesting because I see a lot of this with my first responder clients. Yes. 100%. Because like dad can't be there, right? Or like I've yeah. seen it reverse. Like, don't say that I'm thinking only moms can do this. I've seen dads do this with daughters when mom has been like a first responder and absent, and like and it's interesting because what's happening is a primary parent is taking their hurt, manifesting it through their child,
yeah.
and then getting the cheerleader happiness off of the child of like, yes, yep. you're such a good parent because you're here. Or you're right, daddy's such an asshole because of blank. And so it's crazy because at the same time, most of the time when I'm doing like an assessment with the parent is you'll hear the parent be able to articulate like what they want out of the opposite spouse. Like, you know, this is what I think a husband should do. And like a lot of times it's right down the line of like what would be healthy, you know, protect and bring security yeah. and have safety and be present and all these other things. And then what's funny is they're actually instilling in that opposite sex child everything that they hate. And so it's almost like you have a host situation
yeah.
where like you are literally, you are developing emotionally what you are contemplating or conceptualizing to be the villain in the situation. And I think that I want to take it a step back again is
yeah.
I think you touched on it. Well, I just want to call it out for people that are listening. I don't believe this behavior starts maliciously.
No.
What happens is it starts innocently and it starts in hurt. And then it gets reinforced because we chase comfort. It feels good, feel good, feel good. Mm-hmm. And that's why like when I'll sit down with people that maybe they have 3 or 4 siblings, you can start listening through the siblings if you actually have the ability to work with them. I had a family that I loved. I got to work through the 5 siblings and 1 parent.
Oh, wow.
And what was interesting was walking through with these, you could feel when children started to feel discarded because the next sibling was coming yeah. to an emotional relevance of age. And then that parent would switch to that one. Mm-hmm. And then the only like congruency we had through 4 out of the 5 siblings is we all hate the baby because he has the positioning that we wish we still had, but we aged out of.
Yeah.
And so like why I bring this up is because like, and you've mentioned it as well, is we need to fundamentally change how we look at failure to launch. Cause men absolutely have a responsibility and need to accept, you know, their consequences, mm-hmm. but they've also been asked to play this role.
Yes.
And so how do we turn off that? Because if the secondary gain doesn't exist, this is not a natural process someone would want.
Mm-hmm.
I still struggle to find out why would a 24-year-old male who has ability to provide himself choose to live under someone else's structure unless a secondary gain is being met.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you dove into that. There's a paper from Analysis I want to quote from, and that'll mm-hmm. be second. And then the other one is I just pulled up a bit of research on the phenomena or the syndrome, if you will. So failure to launch, as most define, is the inability, and I would also say choice. Like at times yeah. if there's a secondary game, like I'm going to choose it, but to not being independent and self-reliant. It's common in young adults, especially young men between 18 mm-hmm. to 30, and it refers often to parent dependency and can sometimes be associated with an unhealthy codependent parental dynamic or the emotional investment like we talked about. So yeah. things that we often would see, I imagine, in the case of I've almost developed some sort of dependent personality disorder traits because I realized that's the way that I needed to function in my family system.
Yep.
Therefore, I was robbed of the opportunity to learn how to do a lot of the things to individuate. I have to stay at home, or I've tried to venture out, but I've been shamed by women I've dated for being immature. Like that's one way I see the failure to launch. The other way is why would I want to try if my parents have enabled me to this point? Mm-hmm. I'm not a special angel. I don't like, this is what failure to launch Matthew McConaughey, Bradley Cooper, yep. very handsome guy. Like that whole cast was like, damn, these guys are hot. Like these guys yep. are argue. Obviously it's a movie. So like you see this and, but they have that line in there. And I'm trying to pull up the script for the movie, but they have that line of like, I get all these things. My parents love it. I love it. Why would I change it? Any woman that I want to be with can't come and change me, and they need to be okay with this. Like, there's almost the more narcissistic extension. I'm not saying that as a diagnosis, but like the traits or the psyche yeah. is almost more that I'm special. I'm I deserve special treatment, or I was robbed of the ability to do this, so I feel like I can't function in that. So I'm just going to resign to this position. I don't want to feel the shame of what it would be like for another woman to view this and see how incompetent, like I didn't choose this, but I'm stuck in it, or I love this and anybody who I want to be with has to be okay with it. And obviously that's a very, there's not just those two, but I can kind of see how most or some could fall into one or the both of those categories.
Yeah. It's, I was just listening to you while you were talking there, and you know, I think basically the person we've been outlining here, it's funny because people wouldn't think about this, but if you actually think back to, I know his name's a buzzword out in the world right now, but Andrew Tate, is a failure to launch that went into the other direction, right? Yes. Like he essentially took the toxicity that he was feeling.
Yeah.
Because, and he talks about this all the time of like feeling like, oh, I was like, no one wanted me. No one, I couldn't get a girl. And then what did he do? He essentially weaponized that that toxicity into a way of like making himself actually, I don't know, become good looking to people. I don't know. He developed an attractiveness through toxicity.
Yes. And
so
dark triad personality traits that are very well researched that we have talked about before as well, that are I don't want to say biologically in this, they're almost so innately like arousing and dynamic that it's like that core part of the human species of like must procreate and must further species almost goes in as like, I don't know why this is so disgusting, but desirable at the same time. Like there's so we talk about this with women. They're like, I know he's wrong for me, or I know she's wrong for me. She treats me like shit. Whatever it is, I get treated like shit. They're not great, but they're hot, rich, smart. What other caveat that makes you break down your boundaries and barriers? Because on a primal level, those traits are often what furthers they're ruthless. They would kill for their family, etc. And I'm not bringing everything back to caveman time, but you almost become what you see.
Well, you're not going to undo millions of years of genetics, right? Confidence is a big part of it. True. And the problem is that confidence can be built upon like a not firm foundation. There's a lot of people out there that are overly confident. And even like to the point that's really like thoughts of grandeur that they have no way of being able to fulfill their confidence. But they're going to just sort of sit in that toxic nature of like, well, fake it till you make it.
Right.
And what's interesting is then you'll have truly individuals who wish to have deep and powerful relationships that are trying to do so through healthy means, that because they're not willing to overextend themselves or mislead people, they don't present as having the same level of confidence. And what's interesting is like, pay attention to the two guys as they go back, right? The guy that's not oozing with the charisma and the confidence, what car does he get in and what home does he go to? And versus the other guy who's waiting on an Uber and going back to his parents' place. Like, I would have a ton of confidence in the world too if I knew all my base needs were met and nothing was required of me. And that's what we see.
Yes.
Like, it, you know, in a lot of these cases, we find out like, oh yeah, well, I don't live with my parents, but I live at my parents' beach house, or I don't live with my parents, but I live at like this,
their
or like
house, their basement.
There's some way it's twisted that like, oh no, it's different. It's not the same. But when you really come down to like, okay, so what does this person actually create or do in their life, they sit there and they have nothing to show for it. And that breeds the toxic anxiety that that person also feels. That's why a lot of them have obsessive and addictive components about them, because they are finding their identity in a very short time span. I sometimes sit down with these men when they're sitting in their late 30s or their early 40s and the good looks are gone. The like they've moved out of that social allowance of I can date from 20 to 45. And you're like, they're now into a different spot of like, oh, well, nothing was required of me. Now, I'm not going to give them a pass. They should have been able to pay attention to like, I should probably have something coming down the pipe in regards to what I want to do with my life.
Right.
But I will like lay this at the feet of their parents of like, what did you want that was different? Because you were parenting to have a man child. You were not parenting for this person to actually feel like they had the capability of leaving home. I mean, it's funny because I can say like, I didn't know how to do laundry till I was 26. I had a mom that took care of like a lot of things for me.
Right.
And it was like, it was interesting when I had to learn about that. Now when I'm sitting down with men, they're like, I've never done a load of laundry in my life. And I'm in my 40s. And you don't hear it as a brag. You hear it as like anxiety. Sometimes I get this bubbling up in couples sessions.
Oh, yeah.
Where you actually hear the male come out and say, my greatest fear has been I haven't wanted to tell you I don't know how to cook, or I don't know how to clean, or I've never mopped a floor, or I don't do these things. And what did we save him? We didn't save him anything. He feels embarrassed. He feels shame. He doesn't feel like he can adequately give back into the relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I guess this is where we like sort of pivot maybe a little bit, Talia, to the like, how do you let people start feeling the pain of and consequences of their actions?
Asking the existential questions. I have a couple thoughts on what you shared.
Yeah.
Feeling of... and I've talked about it before on my Instagram. There's weaponized incompetence, but I also think there's weaponized competence. And weaponized competence is that I am so, this is probably more sociological than I was planning on, but there's this bracket of men do, women receive. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying in society, I'm boiling way down, especially in American culture, for sure. That's like my lens that I look through. So I own that. It's the guy goes to work and brings home the bacon and fries it in the pan. Very stereotypical. And I'm not saying that's the goal that we're working towards by any means. Mm-hmm. Then you have this liberation and freedom where we are allowed to have our own bank accounts and credit and checking. And there's not the same need or reliance for marriage. There's a lot of other shifts that happen, which I think are positive. Then you have birth control and the movement of sexual exploration in some ways becoming safer, in some ways becoming more accessible. Mm. And with more accessibility can come a lack of safety. Like you have all of these societal shifts that happen. And underlying this, you have now women who were raised by different generations seeing how subservient women had to be and not wanting to be that way. I'm full support of that. I don't think that we're subservient. I think being in service of in an equal partnership is much different than being subservient to a partner or being entirely reliant on a partner. However, there's a subset that I think it's like an overcorrection or an attempt at a pendulum swing that I have been shown I don't want to rely entirely on my partner. So I'm going to learn to do all of this myself, / I've been socialized to do all of this. I'm the homemaker. You lump in all of those as well. And I am now very, very competent at things because whatever, by choice or by conditioning. And I've partnered because this is where kind of polarity or equilibrium, water seeks its own level, comes in. I see this person who may or may not purport that they can do all of these things. And I go into this almost maternal mode. And if I don't have a child with them, I will show how good of a wife or a mother or whoever I would be in that role by doing it to them and modeling subconsciously what I would be like in that role by projecting it onto them. And I almost weaponize how competent I am, but then I'm resentful that the other person that I may have chosen, they were either like that from the start, they weren't competent in those things from the start, and here I am overcorrecting, or they were competent, but I just wanted it done my way and this and that, and the towels folded a certain way and all these other things that I went and usurped their power and emasculated them. And men don't really do things unless they feel like they can win at it. That's their motivation. Mm. So if they don't feel like they can win and change and shift, and they're going to be like, hey, you do it. Like, you're going to keep
We're super solution focused, right? So like, if it doesn't seem like you're correct. It's so funny because so many men will lock up on like, well, no, it's not about winning. But yes, it is actually a solution process of like, well, if it's going to get completed that way, then I'm going to let it be. Or if I don't feel like I can complete it better, I'm not going to attempt to do it, which is like, that's a winning position. But
I'm not going to waste my resources on that if I don't think it's going to lead to a betterment or a success or a win. Which, again, nobody likes hearing this, I don't think. But if we shift it, it makes sense then why the weaponized competence piece lays into the first existential question of, you know, how do we shift this? How do we change it? It's by understanding there's so many nuanced dynamics that underlie this failure to launch because it's enabling. And if the theory is true, which I believe it is, that we pick our primary partners based on similarities and differences from what we liked or lacked in childhood, that we would pick a woman. If okay, I'm a dude and I'm straight and I'm dating a woman, I would probably pick someone, and this is where Imago therapy comes in, consciously or subconsciously, I want somebody who has all the traits that my parent has that I liked, but I won't really fall in love unless they also have the negative traits that I don't like, so that I can hope to get those childhood needs met, but I stop myself from getting the love I want by responding in my adulthood the same way I did to my childhood frustrations in that way. Storming out, throwing a tantrum, slamming the cabinet, silent treatment. And if we were sent to our room for having big feelings, I withdraw and isolate because I don't like, so much of this underlies that it makes sense in failure to launch. And failure to thrive is a whole other concept with infancy, but failure to launch is almost like the adult manifestation of that. If my mom did everything for me, the archetype and template that I have of what a woman's role is, same thing for women, again, in heteronormative, straight couples, if I have this template of what this is, I'm going to seek that out, which harkens back to how important it is that your child doesn't get to pick their parent. You pick the person that is their parent. Whether or not they stick around, the genetics are there. So it all bespeaks to really having a deep understanding of what are you modeling and what might be helpful for you or rescue you from a fight with your husband, because you'll just do the kids' laundry long term. Could lead to this. I know that's a slippery slope argument. I'm not saying stop laundry, but if you think about how much of these behaviors might be done in service of avoiding a conflict at the marital level, that can underlie that failure to launch. Or we might just really love being a homemaker and doing rhythmic motions releases oxytocin. This could have nothing pathological, and we just like cleaning and doing it, and that's our fun thing, and nobody else had to. Like, it could be as light as that.
Exactly. I think you just have to have the awareness of like, why do I do the things that I do for my child? If it is like, I'm just like, I'm going to bless him by doing his laundry this week. Yeah, no problem. If it's completely what you're doing is removing any agency he has in his life in an attempt to keep him in an allyship with you.
Then
we're talking about something different. And that's what most of these conversations I've been having. That's like, I'll do an hour long consultation with most of these parents before I'll even agree to get into a relationship therapeutically with the child, because I'm trying to understand what am I working up against.
Yeah.
And normally where I'll normally say, okay, well, unfortunately, I'm going to go ahead and pass, or I'm going to recommend you to do your own individual, and I'm going to recommend you to some people I know. Yeah. The reason being is there's an active undermining of the process, because at the end of the day, they will not actually commit to me that they will allow this child to start to fail in different ways. Yeah. The first thing I always hear is, well, I don't want him dead on the street. How do we get from the child safe in your house to him dead in the street? Right. Yeah. Like, and that's where a lot of times I'm like, if you've not thought that you have trauma responses in your life, that statement right there was a trauma response. You immediately have gone to the idea that if he feels anything negative, it will be a complete and utter loss for you in a relationship, in their presence, and a human being.
It's a like, narcissistic perfect self-extension on the parents' end. And it's also assumptory that somebody going through the same thing we may or may not have gone through will experience or feel the same things that we did. It's very much so not allowing the person, which again is sometimes subjective, they're not allowing they're not allowing the person to have their own experience of what they're going through, which makes the implication that they never got to have that, which makes, again, no, I'm saying it's great. It makes sense then why that rescuing comes in. And then I have a quote. I want to hear what you have to say, but I have a quote after that from this paper that I think might really nicely tie into what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when I hear what you just said, I go, oh yes, they're falling into a savior complex because again, this parent has to feel one way or another, maybe feels terrible about the relationship they had with that spouse. And I think it also blooms even more when there is divorce that's in it. So there's this idea of, I'm going to be the one that fixes/helps you. I'm going to be the one that you're going to be successful because of me. Yeah. And the trouble, just listen to that sentence. You're going to be successful because of me, not because of who you are intrinsically, not because of what you're capable of or any other resource that's around you. Yeah. I am the reason you will have the life you will have. Yeah. And so when I ask, like, okay, so a lot of times I'll be like, what's the secondary gains? And I have to go through the explanation with the parent, but I'm like, so, well, what's he required to do at home? Well, he doesn't pay rent. He doesn't pay for groceries. He doesn't pay for his car. He doesn't pay for insurance. He doesn't pay for his phone. It's like, so he's got all of his base needs met. Why would he move out?
All of the wins are there. Why? There's no motive. There's no lack.
At 24, 26, 28 years old, dude, he's living like La Vida Loca.
I'd be like, are you adopting? I know I'm.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'd love to not. Angelina, is this you? So, like, they would totally be like, all right, I'll throw myself up on the, like, I don't know, is there only kids? Like, I'll have an only kids profile. You can adopt me for a week. Yes. So, like, I don't know, I'm down for whatever, man. I gotta buy a house soon. So anyway, like, but oh my god, it brings out the saying, I'll do something strange for a piece of change. But anyways, what it comes back to is like, well, so what would it be like not to pay his phone bill or to start charging him rent or start asking him to pay for groceries? And, whoa. Well, I don't want to upset him. No. You don't want to upset your system.
My darling baby angel boy. He's my sweet little baby angel. Like, I don't. Yeah. Have you not met him?
We're not going to do that to Brexton. So, like, that's like, it's the truth. Like, and it's like, well, so what you're telling me is, and I had this conversation the other day. I said, essentially, you want to pay me to agree with you that it's ridiculous for him to be at home, but you actually don't want me to help him get out of the house.
Yeah, that's it.
And like, there, I could feel the spiciness on the other end, and I get it because I'm confronting an ideal. But yeah. I have to, you do not want what it's you're asking
you.
For.
You didn't call them.
Exactly. And so.
Yeah.
I want to encourage, like, hopefully, like, maybe you identify, like, this is one of my siblings, or maybe you yourself is one of the parents. I think at some point, you have to own that you have set this child up for being completely unable to care for themselves.
Yep.
And I know that that's not easy to hear, but this is what's going to happen. And I have dealt with these calls. Where all of a sudden I get a phone call from someone who says, I've been living with my mother for 30 years and she died of a heart attack.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I've gotten it from sisters who are like, hey, my brother lived with my mom for 30 some odd years. Mom passed away. All the other siblings have agreed we're selling the house, we're splitting up the estate. We have no idea what to do with my brother. He just is himself, right? He goes to the beach, he does what he wants, he parties, but he's aging out of the party scene. Like, if you as a parent aren't willing to take the steps now as you are present to help them launch, you are going to set them up where they will have no one in their corner and they will be in the street. And they will then have to be leaning on other questionable individuals on what their support network is going to look like. And that's the cold hearted, but truth of the facts. Mm-hmm. Like, it's actually better for us to tackle this ahead right now where you're still present You can still be a voice of influence in their life, but they need to put this together.
Mm-hmm. Hugely. Yeah. There's that. I think the other piece of the foundation that I want to cover is this development of, like, the development of self, but also being able to separate and individuate from your family of origin and find your own sense of self. This varies from person to person. So I often see the one partner who did not successfully, is how we will word it, separate and individuate from the family of origin. And so they have this experience where there still is enmeshment at times all the way to dependency. There's still interactional patterns that are sustaining the individual's life, often partnered with someone who did not get to have that, does not have that, individuated quite early on, and learned to be very self-reliant. And so as a way of, I've got my own back. I don't have anybody to protect me or provide for me, whether or not I ever had it and I lost it, so I had to learn it, or I never was given it, so I had to develop from a young age. We seek that balance. So part of what I was going to bring up, it's one of the papers that we have just worked on, but I will say it and then I will unpack it in non-public language. It's called The False Self as a Means of Identification. So it's a case study. So the little intro paragraph is what I think is the most relevant. Winnicott uses the term false self to describe the defensive organization formed by the infant and child as a result of inadequate mothering or failures in empathy. Experiencing either maternal impingement or emotional withdrawal, the infant is forced to accommodate his own needs to the conscious and unconscious needs of those upon whom he is dependent. Infant's compliance is the earliest stage of the false self and belongs to the mother's inability to sense her infant's needs. So this is the case of the needs not being met. Thus, the false self develops as the infant is repeatedly subjected to maternal care that intrudes upon, rejects, or abandons his experience, or the individual experience. As a result, the growing child increasingly loses his sense of initiative and spontaneity, as there is a growing sense in the individual of futility and despair in attempts to do so, or kind of a sense of fate. So the paper goes over the five functions of the false self. So these are other papers that have written about this. It either protects the true self from the impingement or neglect. So I developed this false self to protect myself. I developed it to maintain connection with my mother. I protect my mother from my destructiveness with it. I ward off my anxiety about Oedipal conflicts, which that's a whole other nine episodes plus that we could do. Or it creates a means for me to disidentify from my mother. So to not use, to minimize that, literally on the window and come back, using that in non-analytic terms to help people understand and kind of digest it further. If I need to create a different version of myself to survive, my view on this is that may endure well into adulthood, far beyond the relationship with whom the person I was having it with, the function was there. So like if I needed to create a false self with one person, that does not mean that if I separate or individuate from successfully or unsuccessfully from that person, or to your point, they're not there in my life anymore. That does not mean that that false self or those behaviors of the false self go away. Those become almost intricately interwoven as part of my psyche and personality. And that may get projected onto others who are similar to that person that they originally developed for, or a way of me relating to anybody. And it's like a generalization. So if I develop this false self or this either hyper self-reliant or hyper-dependent on others, that's going to continue and persist in adulthood. And parents have a huge role of interrupting this from unhealthily developing. And it's, your child will need you less the older they get is the goal. The goal is to become obsolete and that sounding board that eventually they will lean on you. And I share this a lot, that when you're parenting an infant and a child, you are in there teaching them everything about the world, as well as trying to protect them from the world and get them in other systems that will also help develop them and be surfaces they define themselves against, as we call it in analysis or analytic thinking. And when the child gets older, the questions go from, well, why? Genuinely, they don't know anything. They're learning everything. Yeah. To, I've learned, I think, enough. Now I'm asking why to push some boundaries. And then as a teenager, I'm asking why maybe after the fact, right? My emotional brain's more online. Why did I do that? I don't know. And then in adulthood, you've made these decisions. So it shifts from, can I do this? To I should or not, and you're just really using your parent as a sounding board to then eventually, like, third step would be, I've done this. Are you proud of me? Do you like it or this? It's just sharing with your adult parent or your parents as an adult, like, hey, I did this. Whereas many years ago, it would have been, should I do this? Can I do this? What happens if I do? We renegotiate our ideally successful individuation from our parents, and we can judge it based on the kinds of questions we ask or statements we share with them.
Well, I feel like it's a perfect definition of successful parenting is where you move from being a primary influence to being a mentorship.
Yes. Yes.
Like there's a friendship mentorship aspect of what that healthy parental dynamic looks like when your child's launched, when they're married, when they're starting their own family. Mm-hmm. And if you find yourself grasping for more than that and grasping for control, or even trying to like control the aspect of influence in their life, like what they should do, then you're most likely struggling with what your identity is.
Yeah.
And that's why I'll normally recommend to those parents, like, be good to do your own work. Cause I think you need to re-harness your voice. You need to arrange your thought processes and then start executing what you want for your own life. Because it's not about just this child for the rest of your life.
No.
And people struggle with that thought process. I mean, so I know that there's probably some people out there that they're like, well, then what did they actually talk about? What do I do? Right. And it's funny because I can feel us both like through the psychoanalytic sort of framework. We're like, okay, awareness. Use something out of the awareness. And you'll probably be fine. But for those individuals that are still sitting there with the grocery list of how do I start, let's talk about like how do you start. I think like, again, you've heard us both talk about it. Like, and I think Talia, you did a great job of outlining like, you know, almost like dodging a bullet of this individual, right? That like it goes back in, mommy, what do I do? Mm-hmm. This is about like actually letting them fail. Like number one is actually saying, hey, we're going to start requiring more of you. And what's funny is most parents are shocked that like, if they were just say, hey, we're going to charge you $400 a month in rent, which is nothing, right? You can't go rent that room anywhere else in Southern California. It's not going to happen. Right. So just saying, hey, $400. Most of the time, what do? They get up and they start their lives.
They're like, oh,
they're like, oh no, why would I do that? Like, and it's, but the parent is so afraid of them leaving that they won't say that. Or hey, why don't you pay for your phone bill or for your car insurance? Or hey, you're 24. Why don't you get your own phone bill? Why don't you get your own car insurance? Like, I understand. I love that we can stay on our parents' health insurance till 26. I think that's a perfectly sound like financial thing.
Yeah.
But your child doesn't have to be still in your sphere of influence in that regards. They can be all over.
Yes.
Now, the challenge is you're not liking what we're saying, probably. You're saying, well, I'm going to have less control if I do that.
Okay. I'm so glad you brought this up because there's the parental level of what to do to change. And then there's the adult child level. So let's stick with the parent for now.
Yeah.
Realizing and recognizing this is a pattern. First step, awareness of why and what are the gains that you're getting from perpetuating the pattern that you may not even realize. It may be so perfunctory, like automatic, that you're like, okay, well, this is just what it is. Please deeply analyze what function and purpose that dynamic is serving. Mm. And that's your role as the parent, the adult. Will in the dynamic. And what would it be like, even if we just mentalize it at first, what would it be like to change that pattern? What are you afraid of in doing so? How could we potentially get ahead of that? And then we need you to face your fear and set these boundaries. And yes, you might have to get your needs met by other people. And I've worked with some families who are like, well, then I'd have to talk to my husband again. And I don't know that I would even like him now. So I'd rather just keep the kids at home because I don't want to be alone with this person that I said I do to 30, 40 years ago or 20 years ago. And the thought of that sounds icky. So to avoid having what my marriage is going to look like post kids, I'm just going to keep them kids in quotes forever.
Exactly.
Yeah. You need to be aware of the dynamic and ask yourself what you get from it. And it's not a fun pill to swallow. I'm not
saying but what I'd want to encourage them in is it actually can be incredibly rewarding. Like
you won't even have a better relationship on the other side of it because there's now more respect, ideally.
So there's like so many different things. Like I love working with couples that are coming into the empty nester feeling. Because what I feel like it is like this mental block, but so many times they're like, oh, like I feel like I'm next to a stranger, right? Like, and a lot of it has been so focused on kids and getting them from college and doing all. I get that you lost connection, but you have more resources than you have ever had in your life. Yeah. And I don't care if you're mega wealthy or you're blue collar or you're middle class, you have more resources. Most likely you have a safe position you're working from. Guess what? You can afford to go out to meals probably now, or you can find ways to invest in yourself. Now, if it's a price objection, it could be another issue. Again, individual therapy, do your own stuff. But in reality, it's like, well, why don't you guys go on a cruise? Well, we don't have time. So you have the physical resources, but you don't have the time. What's keeping, oh, well, the kids are at home, or this is like, I'm sorry, what? Like this isn't a dog. Your child should be able to take care of themselves.
Yeah,
I mean, I worked with a, I worked with a couple that I shit you not, to go away on a 13-day Mediterranean cruise. The mom cooked 3 meals a day, had it all lit, like had it in the glass Tupperware thing, like this is dinner, this is lunch, this is breakfast, and had it set up for the 13 because they had a kid at home. And what's he gonna do?
How old
what's
was he gonna
he, kid was 23.
Oh,
like, and I'm like, well, you maybe if like the kid's coming home to watch the house, either like here's $200 for groceries or something,
or as a thing,
and you do your own thing, or like I don't know, like there's many things that could do. But she was no, I have to cook all those meals, and it was so stressful to have this trip. I could see why the husband would naturally just withdraw. Like, never mind. I'd rather just like not going into
this. I don't want to deal with the lead up to being able to go do this thing. Yeah, that makes
exactly.
sense.
Exactly. And it's like, again, if you have that much stress on you, and that's what I want you to hear. I had empathy for the mom because I'm like,
for sure.
I can't imagine the level of stress on you to say that like, oh, we can't step away from the house because I feel like this grown child isn't going to be able to take care of things. Or where they were worried about like, well, they have a bad habit at not locking doors. And like, it's like, oh man. So like for the rest of your life, you are not going to invest in you or in your marriage. But then you say you're incredibly upset because you're watching all your friends have, you know, better relationships than they ever have had with their spouse, but you won't actually go on a date night.
That's what they show in Failure to Launch, is that couple that they're better than ever. And they're like, what is your secret? So I forget the kid's name, Timmy or something, moved out. And all of them were like, what? How did you do it? How could you live with yourself? Like the range of reactions.
From I love, yes, parents. It's the barbecue moment in the backyard. Yes, it's so great.
When they're at the, like, and we're like, oh, maybe we should. And then, oh, what did you do? Oh, we found the girl. And this is
what
I would bring to. Oh, we found the girl. And it is true to some levels that we are motivated to leave the situation that we're, I'm being brought in, in the beginning specifically or on purpose. We are motivated to leave a situation we're in if we think that better is out there for us, or we've been presented with an opportunity of like, wow, this either new job, new romantic partner, friend, et cetera, is presenting me an opportunity to up-level my life and be more of this next role, right? Going from son or child to adult romantic partner, business person, et cetera. So I think the concept of the movie in that sense of like, if a guy meets a girl, sometimes that is a great motivation to move out of the parents' house. Or I want to be able to, when I'm going out on dates, now that I have the monetary resources, but I'm still living at home to do that, I want to feel confident and ready to do that and not bring a girl home to my parents' house. So I think to that sense, the movie does get it right, that meeting somebody who inspires you to change what you're in can be one of the motivators that both parents can keep an eye out for and children, adult children, if you're listening to this episode, you're like, shit, I think I have the failure to launch. Go put yourself out there. Even if you don't have all the ducks in a row, go expose yourself to what's possible on the other side of this change to motivate yourself to leave the current situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think those are the great starts. And I think maybe this will be a talk that we'll keep coming back with. I would love to hear, like, if anything we said offended you or you want us to break it down more, like, please reach out and let us, like, let's talk more, because I feel like there's so many ways of just accepting responsibility, sort of what we are putting out there socially. Right. Yeah. Cause I think that if we actually look at how we're handicapping our kids and the relationships that they are having or will have, then all of a sudden I normally have quite a bit of allegiance with the parents, right? They're like, okay, how do we reset this? How do we move? But a lot of times is we won't look at that, because it's something that as a parent, you never want to hear, right? You never want to hear that, like, oh, I didn't set my kid up for success in that. It's not so much about being right, wrong, or indifferent. It's about what do we do with what we have in front of us. So, because here's, like, we're running out of time, but the where to go with this is also how we start to get into sort of the lone wolf mental health issues of young males, because males are not feeling actualized. They're not feeling like they're being incentivized to be something greater. And a lot of them, there's another side of this. We've sort of painted the picture of the Matthew McConaughey one, and we've been tongue in cheek with that. But there's the other side that there's, I think, a large number of young males that are in option paralysis, that they have no idea which way to go, because they're being told that masculinity is toxic. And so they're struggling with, like, what is masculinity then? Then what is the, you know, allyship? What does that look like? Mm-hmm. But then I feel inauthentic based off of whatever the allyship, because either I have to be, you know, a man-hating man.
Right.
Like, and, you know, maybe I find natural things that I am attracted to or want to do. Like, the fact that we've sort of, like, we've told men that if they're leaders or if they desire to be leaders, that then they're oppressive in nature is also something that severely is screwing up the male psyche.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it, because we're seeing why the heck do we have also, we can get into the testosterone conversation on a different one, but it's really like there is a shocking number of men that are being prescribed Viagra in their 30s.
Yeah.
Based off the fact that they're in major depressive episodes and they feel like there's no way to lift up. And you might be going, Adam, this is taking it pretty south. But this is what happens, though, when people are not activated and they aren't actualized and they're not pushed to become something.
Right.
Like, because
we reach this despondent disposition. And I think something you touched on as well is modeling how we interact with the person that we are parenting with models what one option of relationships are like, and often the most chosen style of the blueprint. So if I'm treating my, again, very heteronormative here, but if I'm treating my husband like a child and I'm treating my child like a child, what's being modeled to my child is I'm supposed to be treated like a child. Men are incompetent, but I'm not, but it causes an identity crisis, but also we seek what is normal for us. So we're inadvertently perpetuating. And then what's sometimes worse is doubling down of, like, well, my son's more competent than my husband. Like, that's a whole other episode that you've projected onto them. Yeah. I love how deep we are able to go with these conversations. And I'm so curious what listeners are going to take away from this episode. So if you have anything, please, like, email us or message us on Instagram when we post this. We'd love to hear your kindly worded constructive thoughts, and we are happy to unpack anything more if this activated something in you.
Absolutely. I can be found at either Wild Ethos Counseling, or my Instagram for the coaching practice is The Mental Outfitter. So
nice. And I'm at Talia Bombola, and then this will be posted on Between Two Clinicians. So keep an eye out for us. If you like this episode, please download it, like, rate, subscribe it. We want to get this message out to as many people as are willing to listen. So thank you everybody for your time.
And absolutely. We couldn't do this without you.
Exactly. So thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Talk to you soon.